Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. We're back talking about Gaza again today, a topic very important to me. I hope it's important to everyone who listens to this program. And let me just read a headline before I tell you about today's guest. The headline is in several places, but one I'm looking at says, Israeli warplanes bombard Gaza-Egypt borderline. We've had a ceasefire, supposedly, but there's never been a ceasefire. The killing has continued. Israel still has tanks, either in Gaza or can enter at any time. Troops on the ground, same situation. They're still terrorizing Palestinians in the West Bank. Don't hear a word about that in the U.S. media. Arrests, killings, homes bulldozed. It goes on and on and on. It never ends. And, of course, Gaza has been under siege for over a year and a half, and really ever since Hamas was elected. My guest today is Diana Bhutu. She's a West Bank-based attorney. She's a former legal counsel to the Palestinian Authority. And she's on top of this issue all the time. Diana, welcome to the program. Oh, we don't have Diana yet. Oh, okay. Are we connected? Well, she'll be with us. She's in the West Bank. She's based. Oh, wonderful. Diana, are we connected?
Yes, great. Thank you.
Oh, Diana, welcome to the program. I just introduced you, explained that you're a West Bank-based attorney, former legal advisor to the PA, and you're there, and you're following this all the time, and you have for years and years. And it's been a long time, but I can remember years ago seeing you occasionally for brief segments on CNN. I don't watch that stuff too much anymore because they want to keep me from knowing what's going on. They don't want to tell me, which is the reason that I host a program, the Global Research News Hour, because I want people to know what's going on. And I've written a great deal on the Gaza war and now the aftermath, and I read a headline that Israel is bombing again in Gaza. It never ends, Diana. We have a few breaks. There'll be one coming up in a minute or so. But say a few words, and when we hear soft music, a break is coming, and I'll interrupt. But let's kick off the discussion from your point of view. Please go ahead.
You're absolutely right in terms of what's happened today. The latest is that the bombing campaign has continued, and I think that this is one of the things that you're precisely right when it comes to corporate media, that a lot of times we actually don't know what's going on because either because there's a concerted effort to make sure that we don't know what's going on, or because it becomes something that's classified as no longer being newsworthy. And so what's interesting in terms of what happened with Gaza was that there was really no coverage of the fact that Israel had killed 22 people in Gaza from June until December. And it was only when there was this, sudden declaration that there was going to be an end to the ceasefire, the Hudna, the truce, or whatever you want to call it, that's when the news media's ears suddenly started to perk up. But up until that time, it was just a story that wasn't covered, and so too today's events are it's just another story that's simply not covered.
It's awful, Diana. That music means we need to take a break. We'll come back and
okay.
Well, there's a lot to talk about, and I do it regularly on this program. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Diana Bhutu, an attorney based in the West Bank. Diana, again, we discuss this topic all the time on the News Hour, and let me emphasize to listeners that the program is brought to you by globalresearch.ca, and my co-host Michelle Chosudovsky, he'll be hosting a program tomorrow, and I'll be back on Friday hosting another one. We have a pretty heavy schedule next week as well. Diana, it's been explained repeatedly on this program that Hamas instituted a unilateral ceasefire. They kept it for 5 months. Not a single Israeli was killed or injured. And Hamas didn't break the truce. Israel broke the truce. Their forces, whoever they were, they came into Gaza, killed 6 Palestinians. And only then did Hamas respond, as they have every right to do. And from that point to now, Israeli casualties have been very minor. We have no idea how many Israeli soldiers have been killed because Israel won't release it. I think I saw a figure, Diana, that Hamas claims they killed 80 Israeli soldiers. No idea in the world if that's true or not. But Israel is the belligerent. The game we play here, Diana, and our media is absolutely atrocious. You get better media in Israel, where you are. You get better coverage in Haaretz than it's possible to get in the New York Times. It's completely one-sided. Hamas is the villain. Poor Israel, a phrase I like to use, poor Israel, beleaguered, surrounded by hostile Arabs. Poor Hamas, with their automatic rifles, they're challenging Israel with their nuclear arsenal, their F-16s, their attack helicopters. My goodness, the sad part of it, Diana, is that a lot of people in this country believe it. So here we are today.
You're right. I think at the beginning, people definitely began to believe Israel's lie, and that was largely because the media hadn't covered the ceasefire. And more than not covering the ceasefire, they hadn't covered really anything pertaining to Gaza, which is why there were no foreign journalists in Gaza. It was not by accident or by coincidence that there were no foreign journalists. It was because foreign journalists had, by and large, decided that there were other issues that they were going to cover, whether it was the corruption trial, the corruption scandal of Ehud Olmert, or Tzipi Livni's inability to form a cabinet, or the general, Obama fever that had sort of swept the United States and took its shape here. There really were no journalists covering Gaza, and so there was really nobody who was covering not just the ceasefire and what happened during that period, but the fact that there was a very brutal blockade that had been imposed on Gaza. And the first few days of Israel's assault on the Gaza Strip, I agree with you, people really didn't, they believed Israel's myth and they believed Israel's lie. But I think that there was a shift in opinion. And maybe I'm saying this because I'm over here and I have to have a little bit of hope in order to remain to survive. But there was a turning point, I felt, at which when they began to see the hundreds of Palestinian children who were killed and maimed, and some of them very seriously, very, very severely maimed, that I think public opinion somewhat started to shift. It shifted a little bit inside Israel, but not a whole lot, but I think internationally it began to shift. Israel, in terms of recounting why it was that it ended up stopping its assault on Gaza, it actually listed two reasons. One was that it didn't want to come at odds with new President Obama, but also because they really felt that they were losing the PR battle, because as much as they could try to claim that this was a battle against Hamas, when you see 300-plus children, Palestinian children, dead, there's really nothing that you can do to justify that, and there's nothing that you can justify in terms of why it is that humanitarian provisions were simply not allowed into the Gaza Strip. So you're right in terms of the way that the coverage was, and there was a very deliberate reason that there were no foreign journalists there.
And you're talking about what you see in Israel or the Western media. I'm not certain what the TV coverage you get there, probably CNN International, which is a great deal different, Diana, than the CNN that we get here, which, again, is absolutely atrocious. They concentrate more on celebrity profiles than on world news, and the others are as bad or worse, and it's to distract people from what really is going on, from having any idea what real information is. And, again, when it comes to Israel, there's no possibility of getting unbiased coverage. In the U.S., Israel can do no wrong. Hamas is, quote-unquote, a terrorist organization. Not a word that they were democratically elected. Not a word that they have nothing to do with terrorism. Not a word that, international law says you have the right to defend yourself.
Yes, you're precisely right. I mean, there's a fundamental difference between what people have now associated with terrorism and with what is going on in terms of Israel and the Palestinians. There is a phenomenon of global terrorism, or whatever it is, the terminology that you want to use. But Israel cannot label the actions that Palestinian groups are carrying out in the same way that it can be with the other states. It's not to say that it's not as violent. There is certainly a level of violence, and it does kill, but the difference is that this is not a question of the Palestinians just invading another country and just unilaterally deciding that they are going to fire rockets or blow themselves up or carry out any act of violence. There's a definite and distinct link between political actions and the fact that Israel is a military occupier. So this isn't a foreign entity that is somehow attacking Israel. It is by and large the fact that this is the result of years, 41 years, or close to 42 now, 42 years of military occupation and the denial of freedom. So as much as Israel likes to paint the brush, and it's been very successful at painting that brush, using the same brush to paint other acts of violence and label them terrorists, it cannot do the same when it comes to the actions of Palestinian groups, because they are of a different status. They are violent indeed, but the fact that they cannot be labeled with the same brush. And this is why when this assault on the Gaza Strip began, the language that was used was very much the same language that the United States had used in its illegal war on Iraq, which is the question of proportionality, whether it was really acting in self-defense. And what all commentators ignored was the fact that Israel cannot avail itself of the defense of self-defense when it is an occupier. And so all of that should have been cast out the window, but it was not, unfortunately.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, of course, the occupation... this June, the occupation will have gone on for 42 years. And, of course, you've got to go back to pre-1948. Even before the 1948 war, you had Israeli gangs. They were terrorist gangs. The Irgun, what was the other one? one led by Menachem Begin, a future prime minister.
Irgun and the Haganah, Mr. Stern, the three.
Well, the Haganah, the precursor to the Israeli Defense Forces, and they always get the word defense in there, Diana. The IDF, Israeli Defense Forces, and in the U.S. we have the Defense Department. the only time it was ever properly designated here was in World War II, when our Defense Department was called the War Department. Well, it's always been the War Department. And the Israeli military is not a defense force. It's a war force, because Israel has been the aggressor. The only time Israel has been attacked was in 1973, and I remember that very well, the Yom Kippur War. Mm-hmm. But the other wars, even in 1948, Diana, I've written a little about all of this. And Israel, even back then, Israel was the superior military force. And the Arab countries that finally came in did very, very reluctantly. They really didn't want to get involved in this lousy business. So they just kind of made a tepid attempt and sent in small forces, marginal forces, and Israel mopped them up easily. But Israel, from that time, wanted to portray itself as beleaguered and surrounded by hostile forces. And the Palestinians, my goodness, this defenseless population that's characterized as a very dangerous group of people. They're literally cowed by the way Israelis treat them. But again, the way the story is told, it's completely turned upside down. So we have an upside down world.
Yeah, there's really a problem with the world and with the media when when the aggressor is portrayed as being the victim and the victim is portrayed as being the aggressor. There's distinctly a problem with that, and I think that this is where we are important to then seek out and look for other sources of information and really look at what the real and root causes of things are. Because if you're simply just sort of sitting back and watching the evening news, it becomes very easy, and I think this has been a long-term Israeli strategy, to somehow say, oh, gosh, there's just centuries-old conflict, there's cycles of violence, there's just this hatred there, Arabs hate Jews hate Arabs, and that's the end of it, I can't do anything about it, when will these people learn to get along? But and this very thinking also permeates itself in terms of the way that the United States operates, in terms of the State Department and so on and so forth. That I've heard repeatedly individuals come out and say, well, we cannot force the Israelis and the Palestinians to come to some sort of resolution. And what they're basically saying is, and they then add saying, well, only when they tire of killing one another will there be a resolution. But what they're basically doing is they're doing what the average television watcher is doing.
We need to take another break. I apologize. Yeah. We'll be right back.
No, go ahead.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
With Diana Bhutto from the West Bank. Diana, I just got your email on what number to call you on. they do arrive slowly sometimes.
Well, you got me on the right number. So that's
well, we did manage to connect with you, and it's very common sometimes for a guest either to be delayed or whatever. Yesterday, my guest was stuck in traffic and showed up a few minutes late. On Monday, I'm sorry, a few minutes late, but it was no problem. We just keep the thing going and get into high gear as soon as the guest comes on. So I'm getting used to the trials and tribulations of live radio. But getting back to the serious subject, I'm looking at Haaretz right now, Diana, and the lead story on the top of the page, Haaretz Online, Olmertz to George Mitchell, the new U.S. envoy to the Middle East. And there's no question that he's there to represent Israel and not the Palestinians, and he'll deal with Abbas. And I'm not very fond of Mahmoud Abbas, Diana. I respect the democratically elected government.
Good company.
Do you feel the same way?
Absolutely. I think... you know, unfortunately, he was a person who was elected with a very, very, very wide majority in terms of popular support. He was given an overwhelming mandate by a lot of Palestinians, in the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, and had really the ability to represent the Palestinians well and to do well for them. Despite the difficulties of being a government that's under military rule, and despite the difficulties of trying to operate within the paradigm of Oslo and all of that had entailed, but he had a tremendous opportunity, and unfortunately he squandered it. Whether it was relating to internal matters or whether it was just doing what I think any Palestinian president or any Palestinian leader should do, which is simply represent the Palestinians and their interests and not succumb those interests to put those interests second behind the interests of Israel or any other country. And he had the ability to represent us and to represent as well, and chose instead to stay in good favor with the United States and with other countries around the world, believing somehow that those countries would liberate Palestine and not realizing that those countries will not liberate Palestine. These are the very countries that have subjugated Palestine for all of these years. So you're in good company.
I believe that he just plain sold out, and it goes back many years, for the privileges that he's gotten I mean, he's treated like a legitimate head of state, like all others. He shows up in Washington for photo ops with U.S. presidents, European capitals as well, Arab capitals. But his sellout goes back at least to the pre-Oslo days, when Oslo bought nothing whatsoever for the Palestinians. I called it an act of surrender. And distinguished people like Edward Said, I quoted him in language much more beautiful and forceful than I ever could come up with. And I wish I had it in front of me now to read to listeners. Maybe on a future program I will. But, I mean, he just took apart the Oslo process in a way that he could do better than anybody I know. 1993, that infamous September day I remember so well, including where I was when I saw that handshake on the White House lawn.
Yeah, good one.
But Abbas has been well rewarded for his role. And he denounced Hamas for the violence in Gaza. And his prime minister, Fayyad, in the last legislative council elections, he was appointed. He wasn't elected. He got 2.4% of the vote in the election, and
right.
He's the prime minister.
Yeah, his party, not just him, his party got 2.4%.
Well, the party got 2.4%?
Yeah, so it wasn't him personally who got 2.4. It's even watered down. It's his party that got 2.4%.
he personally...
So, I share the criticism. For me, with all of the problems that Oslo entails, and I do understand the structural problems, and I share Edward Said's viewpoint, when it came to Oslo, I think that the only thing that came of, or that could have come from President Mahmoud Abbas was to be an effective spokesperson for the Palestinian people. Nothing more. He could have used the opportunity of visiting these European capitals and going to the White House and really pushing forward the plight of Palestinians and the fact that they've remained under military rule for such a long period of time and the fact that they've been dispossessed for such a long period of time and are being forced to accept and recognize that dispossession and that displacement as being conditioned to being granted their freedom. I mean, this is absolutely perverse and absurd, but yet he didn't do that. And instead, he, as you said, he visited European capitals and he was welcomed into the White House and did very little with the privileged status that he was given. So to his prime minister during the assault on Gaza, decided for the first 13 days of the assault to simply remain silent. We didn't hear a peep from him. He didn't condemn what Israel was doing. In fact, he didn't say anything about it. And instead, he sent out his foreign minister who tacitly blamed Hamas and then who came out very forcefully and indicated that political demonstrations or any sort of uprising or whatever you call it, I mean, just any sort of protest was going to be banned in the West Bank, and indeed they did do that. There were protesters were beaten, protesters were arrested, all the while.
We need to take another break. One more.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. I'm on with Diana Bhutto from the West Bank. Diana, I started to read a Haaretz headline. Let me just finish it. Olmert to George Mitchell. And the headline for Haaretz says, No Gaza Crossings Deal Until Shalit Issue Resolved. Shalit, the Israeli soldier who was captured many months ago by Hamas. This is a cause célèbre in Israel, but there's no mention about who knows how many 10,000-12,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, many of them uncharged, many of them tortured. This isn't something that I'm making up. I mean, this is fact. This happens all the time. And I would imagine, I don't know, I would imagine that this Israeli soldier has been treated reasonably decently. I don't think they're beating him up. I don't think they're pulling out his fingernails. I suspect that when he does get out someday, he'll look in good shape. And if he's honest, he'll say, "Yeah, you know, they didn't treat me like an honored guest, but they didn't do anything to really cause me any harm. I just wanted to go home, and they wouldn't let me." Something like that.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, this is the problem with the way that the United States administration is dealing with this issue. That they put Israel demands above the demands of the Palestinians, and then they never really recognize the parity between the demands or the lack of parity, I guess, between the demands. So, for example, crossing an entire population deserves to be starved because of a soldier, and it's important to keep in mind he's a soldier. A soldier was captured, and that's absurd. That's like saying that the entire country of Israel should also be starved because there are 11,000 Palestinians who are languishing in Israeli prisons. But it's this type of standard that of always constantly raising the bar that somehow the Palestinians are never allowed to resist Israel's military rule. We as Palestinians are supposed to give Israel a peaceful occupation. And this has now become the latest standard. I mean, Hillary Clinton, the new Secretary of State, also today said that she regrets that Hamas is now pushing Israel to invoke its right to self-defense over the fact that it killed a soldier. So again, there seems to be no lie. The only line that seems to be pushed is that Palestinians do not have a right to resist military rule. The only way that they can resist is by being quiet, and they should simply accept Israel's military rule, or else the full weight of Israel will come bearing down on it.
And by quiet, you mean that they should surrender, they should give up their sovereignty, they should give up all their rights. And by starving, of course, you mean the effects of the siege on Gaza, where most everything has been prevented from coming in. And even what does come in is very, very meager, very inadequate, supplies run out. And then Israeli officials say, and they use the euphemism of, we're putting the people on a diet. On a diet.
Mm-hmm.
The whole population is undernourished. And I've written about it. I've written about human rights groups going in and evaluating the state of health of the population before the Gaza war and saying, my goodness, I mean, these people are in terrible shape. And this is Israeli policy. How does a legitimate country function this way? How does the world let them get away with it? It's pretty Arab countries.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, well, it's two reasons. The world's really not looking. And secondly, the Europeans feel, in a way, happy about the situation that's going on. They don't want to have to confront Israel. And so if they can simply provide the foodstuffs and do whatever and make sure that the Palestinians are on some form of life support, well, that's kind of enough for them because they simply don't want to have to confront Israel. The second problem is that I really think that there's a myth of sort of the Arab street and the Arab government coming and rushing to the aid of the Palestinians. It's a myth. It's never happened. It hasn't happened in any Arab country or in any Arab problem. And I think there's a problem with thinking that they're somehow going to rush to the aid. It didn't happen in 48. There were 300,000 refugees before the Arab states actually ended up declaring war on Israel. And it was largely because they didn't want this influx of refugees. That was what led them to declare war on Israel. And so too, when it came to the issue of Gaza, there was certainly a lot of demonstrations around capitals all over the world, but the Arab world didn't really step forward and do a whole lot. I'm not sure it could do a whole lot, but I think the problem is that the world is simply not looking.
Well, they're not looking. And again, people in my country, I think for the most part, literally don't know what's going on. The only time there's ever any news about what's going on somewhere else, other than celebrity-related sports, whatever, is when there's a war going on, usually one that the U.S. is involved in, or Israel is involved in terms of Israel is the victim, and whoever Israel is fighting is the aggressor. One thing I wanted to ask you, Diana, just to shift gears a little bit. You're in the West Bank. You're in Ramallah, the headquarters of the PA. I've written a lot about the tremendous restrictions on virtually everything for Palestinians in the West Bank in terms of checkpoints and isolated communities and roads for Jews only. Well, you're there. Describe what it's like for you.
It's a fantastic question, and it's really difficult to describe other than to say that there was nothing in my upbringing, in my Canadian upbringing, that that trains you how not to be free. And so when you come here, you have to put aside all of these notions that you have of freedom and imagine what it's like not to be free. So basic things like not knowing whether you will be able to get to your university because you don't know if there are checkpoints and roadblocks. If you do make it there, you don't know if you're going to be arrested by the Israeli authorities. If you need to get vegetables and fruits, you don't know what vegetables and fruits are being allowed in that day. You don't know what supplies are coming in or going out. You want to visit your friends and family. You don't know if you'll be able to cross. You randomly hear of the army coming in into Ramallah and to other cities and arresting people. The ability to get medical treatment is curtailed. The ability of school children to be able to go to schools freely has been blocked. There's some schools that are behind, literally behind the wall. There's a community, and then the school is on the other side of the wall. And they have to pass through a series of Israeli checkpoints to get to school. Then you hear about home demolitions and what's going on there. And so there's really nothing, other than to say that you just simply don't have freedom, and all that entails on a daily basis for an American citizen. And just to pose that with what it would be like to not have freedom and to have to live under all of these restrictions, while at the same time seeing another group of people able to freely move, able to freely take away your land, able to freely build a new road on your land, a new apartment on your land. And so it's a context of superior rights. And it's difficult, it's really difficult to describe other than when you come here and live here and see what it's like and go through the daily routine of not knowing and the gross uncertainty that there is that comes with occupation.
And it can get very serious at times. There are cases where seriously ill people are prevented from getting through a checkpoint to get medical care. Pregnant women mm-hmm. who might give birth any moment, women who give birth at checkpoints because soldiers will not allow them through to get proper medical care. Simpler things, but still very, very, very harassing, where families need to get through a checkpoint to get home. Now, maybe they came out right. for some reason to visit someone or go somewhere else, and they want to go back through. You know, in Chicago, where I live, it would be like waiting for a red light to turn green so I can keep going. There, it's a family right. to pass through this checkpoint. Why should it be there in the first place? But it is. And families not allowed to go through to get back to their own home. And of course, this is done deliberately to harass people. And that's minor stuff oh. compared to not being able to get to vitally needed medical care, or for your home to be bulldozed, or your land seized, or for agricultural land to be razed, or this horrible separation wall that's going up, stealing 10% or more of the West Bank, that's walling people in, keeping farmers from tilling their land. And as I understand it, Diana, if for any reason a farmer is walled out and can't get through to take care of his land, if that goes on for a certain period of time, maybe a year or so, then the land is considered public property and Israel can seize it. But the
right.
farmer wants to get through.
Right. And
go ahead.
And this is the problem is that all of these things that we're raising, all these instances and examples, the overwhelming problem in my mind is not just that these incidents occur, it's that the but there's no address, there's no redress that can be sought. There's nowhere that the Palestinians can go to get their wrongs righted, to get things fixed. So, for example, there is no, the Israeli Supreme Court is hardly considered to be a liberal court when it comes to the Palestinians. It is when it comes to internal Jewish Israeli matters, but hardly when it comes to the Palestinians. And so there is no redress. There's no place a Palestinian can go to try to seek a prohibition against torture. There's no place a Palestinian can go to seek a prohibition of their property being stolen, a place a person can go to get to redress the issue of inadequate health care, of the fact that that they have to go through a series of checkpoints, the fact that there's a wall, the fact that children have to go through the wall to get to school, the fact that there are home demolitions, all of these things, or even killing. I mean, the issue of killing, which in the United States raises a lot of eyebrows and questions, and there's always a debate when it comes to that. This issue is an issue that is simply not debated, and there's no avenue for redress. And so this is why there's this feeling of helplessness, a feeling of hopelessness, and a feeling that Palestinians only have themselves to turn to. They have no other address to turn to. The world is simply remaining silent. And so it's a combination of occupation, the denial of freedom, and the fact that there's no address that's available to help the Palestinians out.
And the same thing happens inside Israel for Israeli Arabs, Palestinians who are Israeli citizens. Israel has no constitution. It has its basic laws. But the laws really are for Jews alone. Israel is a theocracy. It's a state that really looks down on all other religions, including Christianity. Jews are the ones who get the rights, and of course Muslims get the fewest rights, but Christians as well. What kind of a country calls itself a democracy and operates this way? It really isn't, in many respects, Diana, it's not a lot better here, except it's not very likely that the U.S. Army is going to break down my front door and come in and evict me or arrest me or something or other. But, of course, in the West Bank, in Gaza, the Israeli military or security forces can, on no pretext whatsoever, come into a village, come into a small town, come into anybody's home, and make arrests or do anything they please. And then you've got the settlers, the Israeli settlers, the illegal settlers, in violation of Geneva laws. An occupying power cannot settle its own people on somebody else's territory or expel the people the territory belongs to. But, of course, Israel has done this for many years. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers on expropriated Palestinian land. And the settlers, many of them are armed, And they can cause some serious harm to Palestinians, including killing them, and get away with it.
That's right.
Again, what kind
this
of a country?
Right. It's the superiority of rights, and this is precisely the problem. Is that
because Jews,
if you are with, sorry,
I was just going to say because Jews are looked on as special, and other people are lesser people, and when it comes to Muslims, they're in a category of subhumans, Diana. But you pick it up.
this is precisely the problem when you look at Israel. That you're right; it is a theocracy. It considers itself a democracy, but it's a democracy only for Jewish citizens, and it's not a democracy when it comes to anybody who's not Jewish. In fact, now the third largest, or slated to be the third largest political party, is a party that's called Israel Beiteinu, which means Israel is our home. This party is a party that not only advocates the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the West Bank and Gaza Strip, but actually advocates the ethnic cleansing of Palestinian citizens of Israel and says and wants to put these citizens of Israel to what they call a loyalty test, that if they are not loyal to the state of Israel, that they should not get citizenship and should be expelled. And so, and when it came to just last week, when there were a few Arab parties that were delisted by the Elections Commission inside Israel because of the fact that they don't believe in Zionism and don't recognize Israel as a Jewish state, which incidentally most countries around the world haven't recognized Israel's state either, they were delisted, and this very party that slated to be the third largest party was the party that came forward and said that they need to get rid of the Israeli Supreme Court, and they need to get rid of these parties because if they don't get rid of these parties, they represent the fifth column inside Israel. And so you're right, it is absolutely a theocracy.
Well, it's easy to invent any story that you want to justify what you want to do. So to think of your own citizens who are peaceful, they're not bothering anybody, they're not attacking anybody, they're not threatening anybody, and you call them a fifth column for the only reason that you want to get rid of them. You want Israel to be a state only for Jews. You want all non-Jews out. You want an ethnically pure state. This has very strong echoes of Nazi Germany that wanted an Aryan state. I don't see any difference. And the techniques are pretty much the same, except for, you know, the gas chambers and the ovens. Israel takes the process in a little bit more slow motion style. But it really is the same thing. And the world goes along with it. The big difference is that the world goes along with it, but it lets Israel get away with this.
Right, and not only does it let Israel get away with it, the problem is that it doesn't recognize the step that Israel's taking and the fact that this is a process of ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. I mean, if you think back in history, how is it that you create a Jewish state in an area that is not, that does not have a...
We need to take another break, Diana. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Diana Bhutto. Diana, we just have a few minutes left. I want to give it to you to wrap up the program. Anything else we left out that you think is important, your own involvement and so on, please go on and explain. I'm sorry? Oh, you lost her. Oh, my goodness. You want to try to get her back? Well, let me make a few comments. We'll see if we get Diana back. That can happen every now and then. This is a big issue for me ever since the Israel attacked Gaza on December 27th. It's been a month now. I've written about 10 articles. I simply cannot get off this topic, but the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is a core issue for me. I simply cannot stand injustice, and where it's the greatest is where I want to go. As time allows me to, I can't go everywhere. There's too much going on around the world. But this is a big one for me. And I firmly believe there's no possibility of peace in the Middle East until and unless this problem is solved. Have we got Diana?
Yes, I'm back.
Oh, Diana, I apologize. We just have a couple of minutes left. Wrap up whatever we left out that you think is important to pass on to listeners.
I think that it's really important to recognize that, you know, to really keep your to keep one's eye on what's happening here and to recognize that this is a part of an ongoing strategy, a long-term strategy on the part of Israel to either, you know, to get rid of the Palestinians, take their land, and keep those Palestinians who actually remain, to keep them subjugated to the point where they're no longer allowed to resist against military rule. This is what I think Israel's long-term strategy is, and this is what I think is playing itself out. And I really want people to pay attention to what's going to happen with this new administration. And I really don't want to see a president who's simply a good orator, but a president who is going to act and who's actually going to do something. And I'm afraid that I worry that that's not going to happen.
Oh, I think the chance of it happening, Diana, I hate to say it, I think the chance of it happening is dead zero. I've written about all of his key appointees, political, economic, and so on. And when it came to the team that will be involved in the Middle East in any way, the title of my article was Obama's War Cabinet. He will continue the same belligerency, the same one-sidedness. And I've quoted him many times, including at AIPAC conventions, in campaign speeches. He is absolutely 100% committed to Israel, And it's why James Petras, who's been a frequent guest on this program, he'll be back in mid-February. He calls Obama the first Jewish president. He is bought and paid for, I'm sorry to say. So it's up to us. We have to stir the pot. We have to build an effort at the grassroots and make something happen.
I agree. Can't agree more.
It has been a delight to have you on. We'll hear the concluding music begin in a moment or so. But it was wonderful having you on. I had two Gaza guests a week or so ago. Musa El Haddad was one. And I wanted listeners to hear from people who've gone through the conflict and what's going on. And I'll continue to do that. But I'm afraid we're out of time, Diana, and I just want to thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Diana.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And please come back tomorrow. Michelle Josadovsky will be hosting, and I'll be back on Friday. Back then.